welcome to Data Science Perspectives. This series focuses on analytics and data science professionals from across industry to learn about how their career unfolded, what skills they look for when hiring, and what trends they think are coming next. I'm your host, Bill Franks. Let's get to it. Welcome to Data Science Perspectives. I'm your host, Bill Franks. Today we're going to be joined by Bernie Smith from the Institute for Clever Stuff over in London. I've known Bernie for about 10 years, and when I first met him, he was actually hitting up analytics for Sainsbury's, who's the UK's second largest retailer. He helped them overhaul their analytics organization as well as many of the analytics that they did, and I recall he was able to document something awesome like a 13 or 14 times return on that investment. We'll talk about that in a little bit. He left Sainsbury to start his own company, the Institute for Clever Stuff, which is a research and advisory firm. And with this firm, he helps large organizations implement innovative analytics, both in terms of getting them built and successfully implementing them at scale. Applying everything he learned from his prior roles, he's been able to grow the company quickly, including growth throughout the COVID period, which is quite impressive. Before Sainsbury's, Bernie spent a long time in the consulting realm with major stints at companies such as EY and KPMG. It was here that he was able to get exposure to a range of large companies to form his own philosophy and outlook around analytics. As you'll see, he's from England and has a business degree from University of London City. With that, let's welcome Bernie to the show. Welcome to the show, Bernie.
Nice to see you, Bill. Yeah, really good to catch up.
You know, the thing I always like to start with first is everyone's story is different about how they got into this whole area of analytics, data science, artificial intelligence and such. What initially drew you into this world? How'd you get involved?
Oh, wow. I guess I came full circle, actually. I mean, when I first started out many, many years ago in consulting, I'm showing my age now, it was in the midst of the dot-com bubble era. And there was lots of change going on. And so, you know, solving complex problems was really critical and key. I worked in Big Four consulting. And so a lot of the change programs that we're involved in were kind of changing the nature of the focus that they had. And so, you know, getting results with confidence and certainty became really important overnight. And so I used the early days of that kind of change program and being involved in change on a pretty large basis to introduce analytics and start to use analytics in the rudimentary sense back then. But then to grow it out. So that was kind of the first dabbling with it. And then I also joined a startup in customer service measurement and strategy. And that was really kind of like a baptism of fire into analytics and the data space. And it was quite amazing the complexity that we're working with during that time, but also the joy that you could create for customers using analytics in the right way and really kind of refining the proposition for organizations to customers as well. So that's kind of how I dove into it. And I guess it's very similar to where we are now, actually, Bill. You know, you think about the world around us, the complexity of change going on, inflationary pressures, COVID, the pandemic, the move to digital. There's lots of change pressures on organizations, and analytics is right at the heart of that to give confidence and help organizations make better decisions. And so, you know, always been part of my inherent nature from my early part of my career. And I guess, you know, throughout my career, I've always tried to balance science with art. So the science of mathematics, statistics and economics, with the art of storytelling and that gut instinct that you have when you do a role for a period of time. And the most fascinating period I had was working with a big retailer in the UK, where you're kind of balancing science and art in everyday decisions, you know, working with people who've had long-term careers in their specific field, really understanding the business intimately and having that gut instinct to make decisions, but then introducing some of the mathematical and scientific elements that can really help them make better decisions and give confidence and also model out things at speed as well. So that's kind of how I entered it. And actually it's kind of carried on as that theme throughout. And I find myself today in the midst of another complex set of situations where we're making change and decisions on behalf of organizations or with organizations using data science and analytics to help with that. So, yeah.
Well, I love your line when you said the joy of analytics. Only people who are in the field would think of using such a phrase. I love it. I haven't heard that one before, yeah. But I may borrow that at some point.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So you
and I think it is a joy, actually. To kind of pick up on that very quickly, because if you think about when you make decisions in your personal life around buying a house or a car, you tend to ask questions, and we're very good at asking questions in our daily personal lives. We're less so in business. And so there is a joy to kind of discovering those questions. But there's also a joy to then being selective about how much analysis you do to support those as well. And I think, you know, the house analogy is a great one. You know, we tend to ask lots of questions. We get lots of data points to answer those questions. Sometimes it's very indicative, and other times we've got high confidence in the data. But we assimilate decisions on that basis. And it's, again, a mix of science and art. And that's something we want to bring into the business world as well. And I think that's where there's a real joy to it, is having that balance.
What's under joy, I think, ties to you mentioned about, you know, the art and the science blending. And I know, you know, I've been a big proponent of that. And people who have been in the field for a while tend to see that angle. And I think you're right, because as you talk about finding those questions and asking them and understanding what data is there, you know, from the outside, it might seem that that's all pure science, pure logic. But while there's a lot of science and logic in what you do with that final data set, to get to that data set, there is a lot of art in what questions should I be asking, and how do they interrelate, and what data does that lead me towards and away from, et cetera. So I think, you know, what do you think of when you mentioned the art with the science? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, it's exactly that, I think. I mean, you know, starting with a really clear business question is really important. You know, quite often we tend to dive into solutions. And so I think there's an inherent skill in actually, you know, a data scientist asking what is the question you're trying to answer and getting some of the backstory. And so the art side is really about that kind of storytelling, the backstory, why that question is important, how we refine that question and step into the shoes of the decision maker. And then spending some time saying, well, actually, if you were to answer that question in the right way, what's the outcome you're looking to achieve? You know, what's the outcome 1 year in an ideal world from now? And I think the narrative is often missing. You know, sometimes we'll get a glimpse of part of a question, and then we'll dive into trying to solve that question, whether it's around, you know, machine learning techniques, whether it's around, you know, very simple prediction or patterns, looking at, you know, simple things like sales. You know, we tend to try and dive at the solution almost immediately. And so the art part is having that journey of discovery and spending time to think about what's the question we're trying to really answer? How do we refine it and make sure it's the best question we can be articulating before we get started on it? And then often asking the people who've got the experience in those roles, you know, where would you expect us to be if we were to answer that question? If in an ideal world we got the best answer possible, what's the outcome that could be achieved? And I think the narrative is often missing, and that's a really important part of it. And again, it comes back to that joy piece. You know, if you can get into the narrative and really understand that and share that amongst the people involved in that discussion, I think is critical. And actually, we developed a process called conversational analytics that is absolutely wedded to driving that conversation in the right way. So it starts with a really clear business question and then starts to go through what's the backstory as to why that's important. What exploration can we do and what ideas can we inject into it and how do we innovate around it? And then how do we tell that story in a way that's really engaging and effective and generates leadership so that what we can eventually get to is making a decision and driving an outcome that gets results. And it's really hard to do that just with the analytics alone. But if you broaden it out to be the conversation and the story and blending that science with art, it works really well.
Yeah, you know, I agree 100% with everything you said. And I think the unfortunate thing is that for the most part, and I say can say this coming from a university with a program in data science, that, you know, curriculums at universities through formal education are still focused, I think, overly might be the wrong word. You need to have all the technical foundations and all the theoretical knowledge, but they don't focus enough on some of those things you talked about defining the narrative, just telling the story, and you know, people have to go out in the workforce and then learn how to do all that on their own, which I think is what, you know, everyone from your and my generation has had to do, was learn that on their own. And I feel like over time, hopefully we can start to come up with ways to prepare students as they're coming up to know that, and people junior in their career, so they don't just have to do it through brute force and experience, which is often hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a really interesting one, because we're working with actually a couple of fairly large firms, a global organization, but also a consulting firm. And they index very hard on actually trying to upskill their business teams and business leaders with an understanding of data science. But they don't do the reverse, which is, you know, how do you really kind of get into the heart of actually how you make decisions in organizations? How do you build some of those, I guess, almost consulting skills? Mm-hmm. So how do you, you know, explore problems, turn those into questions, really understand the backstory and drive that backstory with real clarity. And then actually, you know, build that story into a longer term narrative. Because the other part of it, I think, is when we do a lot of analytical work, we tend to treat it as one-time pieces of work, and there's a lot of reusability within those. And so I think the more we can talk about the stories of how we've solved problems in the past, build case studies, talk about that narrative of how we made decisions, actually becomes infectious, and you end up with lots of reusable assets as a result, and people thinking about data science as part of every decision, rather than actually a separate function that comes in for a discrete piece of work and then goes out again. And so weaving it throughout that, we found really, really useful, actually. But developing those skills, those softer skills, isn't as easy to teach. It partly comes through, you know, some cues and some methods that you can teach, but it comes through a lot of experience, you know, actually probing into questions, refining them, challenging a little bit, making sure that there's a really good understanding of the starting point and that business question you start with before you kind of start to endeavor on any analysis or even data gathering, really. So, yeah.
Well, I know you talk about, you just mentioned and hinted at, you know, results, et cetera. I know when I first met you, when you were at Sainsbury's, heading their analytics organization, you know, one of the big challenges across the industry is people being able to document and prove the ROI of what they did. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you had one of the best stories I know of. You actually were able to get officially documented and accepted, if I recall, something just north of a 12X, like a 13, 14X return that the company agreed to, not just you making that claim. I'm sure there'd be a lot of people out there who would love to know, how did you go about doing that, both in terms of, you know, if you have any guidance on the kind of measures you use, but equally so on the politics of actually getting people to agree that you had that big of an impact?
Yeah, I mean, I think I probably had a bit of an unfair start in that, you know, retail is a very hard environment. And so when you're trying to build traction in analytics, it's very much focused on the margin that you make. And, you know, grocery retail is particularly challenging from that point of view. But actually, what that gave me was a very fair start as well, in that, you know, people ask those questions straight away. You know, if we give you some money to do this, how are we going to know and be sure that it's going to be invested in the right areas? There's a very old adage in grocery retail, which is, you know, every pound has an opportunity cost. And so, again, you know, thinking about that, that very kind of cautious approach to investing in certain areas, or doing it only when you've got certainty, really drove a discipline in my mind. And so when I first started there, I kind of put this proposition forward and said, look, we want to do these things. But to do these things, we need to invest a little bit. But actually, I'll build up a funding pot myself. So what we'll do for the first 6 months is we'll ask for zero funding. So we actually said, well, we don't want any funding additional to what we have already. Okay. We'll utilize the team. And what we'll do is we'll go out and find savings. We'll find ways that we can build operational effectiveness, you know, reduce some of the activity that was going on around reporting, cut out reports and cut out some of the less valuable items that were going on to reinvest in what we could do as part of our program. But in order to do that, we had to measure everything. So every time we started with a question, you know, actually a simple one there, you know, how do we cut out reporting to drive a 15% saving and free up time to do value add stuff? We'd write it down, we'd then start to track against it and measure against it in terms of the value recorded. So we can start to look, you know, not just driving value commercially and operationally, but in terms of ethically as well. So how much time can you free up? How much stress can you remove from people's decision-making processes? And how much of that investment commercially and operationally can we reinvest, be it time or financial pounds, back into doing more and actually then seeing if we can exponentially grow what we did. And so we started out by logging everything, and everything we cut out, we took a numerical value, and that was quite easy. You know, you can actually assess pretty easily how much time goes in, how much cost goes into producing a report or a data set. Where it becomes a lot harder is when you start to answer analytical questions and you start to ask questions. You know, a great one we started in the early days was, how do we improve promotional return investment effectiveness to drive additional sales, but also give the customers a better proposition? Now, on the face of it, that's, you know, that's quite a complex question. You're doing a lot of modeling, predictive techniques. You're looking at promotional return investment. You're then separating out genuine sales from attributed sales that can be due down to things like cannibalization, which is cannibalizing other product sales. Or it could be pull forward, you know, where you're actually pulling forward a purchase from a later date that would have been at full price to today when it's on promotion. And so there's a lot within there that can affect the return on investment and the dynamics of that. So we started to break that down. And in terms of understanding what the value outcome would be, We start with that business question. We then start to say, well, how do we build a team to answer that question and what are the components involved? And the very first day, we almost finger in the air say, how much value do we think if we were to solve that problem against a single category or even a single SKU, could we create? And so day one might be finger in the air. And then as you get further into the question, we have that as part of the regular narrative. So as part of our daily stand-ups, we say, you know, we said when we started this question, we could achieve 15 million of return. Now we're 2 days into it. Do we still believe that 15 million is true? And so you constantly poll each time someone has a different opinion, and then you track that over time. And that gives you a view on how good are we at estimating effectively. And then as you start to do a test and learn against a product, you can then capture the actual results. Now, you can do that against one question, which is, you know, quite valuable. But then what you can do is build up a library against multiple questions and reuse them. So you can say, well, actually, you know, Bill's really good at estimating. So when we start a new question, we'll get Bill involved because he's much better than Bernie at estimating from day one. Where Bernie comes into his own, he's a bit better at kind of tracking the actual realized value. And so, you know, maybe Bernie's estimates come through a bit later and we start to use him on that side. And so you build up quite a rich picture, a bit of a library, a digital library of use cases against questions, but also the return on investment value against those. And then you can map those to new questions in the future. And that was kind of the methodology. And in terms of how we did it, obviously we looked at, you know, commercial value. We also looked at time saving, the contribution to decision making. And so that'd be very much a conversation with stakeholders. The question around how much additional value can we drive? How much can we automate? How much can we direct to self-service? All these value points come into it. And then we had some other quantifiable measures around what's the reach of this question? How far could we reach into the business and how much can we scale and repeat this? What's the impact on the business? So financially, commercially, operationally in terms of time savings, and ethically in terms of better decision-making and confidence and well-being as well. And then we had the confidence challenge. We said, well, how confident were you in answering that question and confident in the return? And over time, you build this nice long list of all the questions you've answered. You can see what your valuation was when you started them and what your realization point was, at what point in the process you got more confident. You can then aggregate those to give you your total value returned. And then the really nice bit, Bill, is, you know, you can do analysis on that. You can start to take that example of where you're better than me at the original estimate, but you can do that across a large team group and you can start to see, well, what teams get a better return on the investment and how do you combine those? Which individuals are better at leading them and how do you get them to lead the new propositions? Which submodules within a question, so the promotional return investment question, could we use the sales forecasting engine for another purpose? And we know that the sales forecasting engine enabled us to make a decision slightly faster in that process. So could we apply that to, you know, fast moving fashion goods and seeing if we can get a better prediction on when we might go out of stock on certain items? And then taking the data points for each of those and taking the values for each of those, whether it's an additional day of sales, whether it's a broader reach into a broader range of products, and scaling them out gave us a really good indication. But then we'd also get them signed off. So we show this process to each of the stakeholders from the initial valuation through to how we're producing the method and the methodology through to getting the results. And then we'd sign off each line item, and where we had real confidence, we'd put that into the hopper and say, well, we know that we got a, you know, 5 or 10 times return on investment against that. For others, we might have a dilutory effect because we don't know the full scaling of it. And so we might factor it down slightly. But on aggregate and on average, we were achieving the returns that you talked about. And it was a real boost for the team because they could tangibly see the impact they were having, as well as, you know, decision makers going, well, actually, I know if I invest in that amount of money in that area, we should be expecting a return of this magnitude. And so it became a really key part of our proposition. And what we do now is very similar. We've kind of broadened that out into a more complex and scientific method where we can look up a library of previous use cases and compare those to new questions, as well as using the iterative approach from, you know, finger in the air through to starting to analyze through to then tracking actual results. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that's great. Thank you. And it definitely some good detail for folks who struggle with how to do that. You know, having taken that experience, you ended up founding your own company now, this Institute of Clever Stuff. So What advice would you have for someone else out there who's maybe working for a big company now, but thinking of launching their own business? Are there one or two, here's a great thing about it, and one or two, gosh, this kind of bit me initially until I figured it out that you'd advise people?
Yeah. So the warts and all. So I think the journey to becoming an entrepreneur is an interesting one. I mean, I chose, I worked through Big Four Consulting. I was part of another startup in consulting. I then switched sides and moved from consulting into an operational role, with the retailer we talked about, where I was actually involved directly with decision making. And so that made my kind of informed view of how to make better decisions really quite comprehensive. And I was really pleased that I did that switching. I have to be honest, I felt a little bit of a fraud in consulting, because in consulting you advise people and you have conversations around how they can do things better, but you may not have done it yourself. And so you kind of give advice and then you help them reach a point where they're making a decision. And then you have the luxury of being able to walk away when they have to realize the results and the value. And so switching sides was really kind of powerful from that point of view, because it meant I had to live with the consequences of my advice, make sure the results were realized, and go back to that measurability and demonstrate the value right the way through, and also see how boards operate. So when I set my own business up, it was founded on that kind of premise of, actually, what I'd love to be able to do is take the supply side experience of being able to advise organizations with the real experience of actually helping to make organizations make better decisions from inside, and blend those things together. And so I didn't find the move daunting at all. I really enjoyed it and was very excited by the vision of what we could create. The hardest bit, though, is getting other people to be passionate and believe in that vision, because when you're in a big organization with a brand, it's quite easy to say, look, I work for company X, and isn't it exciting we're doing this, and why don't you come and join us? When you're on your own and you're trying to convince your first employee to join you, or we recruited a CEO recently, when you try and convince somebody to leave an organization where they're making a real impact and join you, that's quite tough. And you've got to think carefully around, how do you get them engaged in the vision and the journey? So that's probably the hardest bit, is trying to relay your thoughts and vision to other people, even if you're not quite at that stage and you're growing towards it. I think the second part is, I think there's so many people with great ideas, and I think more people should be entrepreneurs. But if you can do it off the back of having some experience working in a large organization, it helps you with navigating the complexities of politics, of landing contracts, of the legal side, of actually making things practical so you can execute on them rather than just talk about the vision and the ideas behind it. So I've really enjoyed the move. I'd encourage other people to do it. I would do it cautiously, because there are very tough days and there's a lot of loneliness, because when you start a business, you tend to do it either on your own or maybe with a very small group. And so there's not so many people you can turn to for support and advice. But having a good network around you, asking the right questions, thinking about some of the principles we've talked about, I think it'll stand most people in good stead. So I'd encourage more people to try it for sure.
Now, I think you probably had a little bit of an advantage, having come from the consulting world where you knew a lot of people and you had a network. You at least had folks that you could call to start that painful process of, hey, I really have a credible idea here I'd like to talk to you about, versus if someone had been purely, especially you say one big company for many, many years, there's certainly credibility in that, but you might not be well known outside of there. And I think the startup could be much harder. I see a lot of people, I think, underestimate how hard it is to get people to talk to you and return your call. Even when you do work for a big company, because everyone's busy, let alone if you're calling from a company they've never heard about, if they don't know you.
Hey, absolutely. And I think, I guess there's kind of two parts that were daunting at the same time, but actually worked out to be really, really positive. I think the first is the name. The name is quite cheeky, but it's also quite bold. The Institute of Clever Stuff. We work with quite a lot of academics to bring academic thinking into the commercial world and commercial thinking into academia. And so we genuinely want to be a body of learning, but then we put a slightly cheeky spin on it with the clever stuff part.
Right.
And that's got quite a lot of cut through, and it's meant that it's shown a human side, a kind of playful side. We've been very honest about where we are on our journey and how big or small we are at different times, and working on the ethical side. And I think that's really resonated with people. So that's actually made it easier. We've been very fortunate that we've grown and pretty much doubled in size year on year, which has been fantastic. But the other side is, when you're talking about that as an initial story to people, you don't have that big brand behind you. People don't look at it and go, well, actually, oh yeah, I know who you are and know what you're about. And so there's a lot of work you need to do in the, I don't want to use the word selling because that's a bit hard, but rapport building and demonstrating the credibility and the value you can bring, showing some of the use cases that you've worked on and talking about that return on investment value, and really kind of building the confidence in what you can do. And I think that's, so it's been you know, fantastic journey. It's hard at times, but it's been great overall, and I've really enjoyed it so far. So yeah.
Well, one thing I always like to get a perspective on, I think you might have some really good ones here, because you focus so much over your career and currently on helping with innovation and driving analytics to the next level. If you had to pick one or two things over the next, say, 3 to 5 years, you know, that are going to be the, you know, some big trends or high impact methodologies that are coming down the road towards us, what would you think those would be?
Well, gosh. So I think, you know, I think it comes back to what I said at the very beginning of the conversation, Bill. I mean, we're in a period of disruption like we've never seen before. And I think so we need analytics more now than ever. So if you think about big disruption, we've got it everywhere. We've got COVID, there's world trade protectionism, there's economic change, there's uncertainty in the macro environment with inflation running high and interest rates as low as they are and starting to creep up. There's been scarcity issues and availability issues for the last few years. And then we have that compounded by climate change and a generational shift as well. I think people are starting to look to organizations and leaders as well for, you know, that purpose, meaning and value that you don't necessarily get in everyday life. And so we're becoming a lot more discerning, I think, in terms of the organizations we buy from, the leaders we look to, you know, how much we trust people and agree with their conviction in their thinking. You know, we can all talk about quite horror stories we've seen in our politicians and how they've handled the macro environment or COVID. And so I think people are quite skeptical about that. But if I think about this kind of complexity of the world we're in, I think the very first thing in terms of the big trend will be around how do you solve complex problems with confidence? How do you model things out at pace and speed so you can see what things may result and what the outcomes might be? And how do you jump ahead and predict with certainty so you can start to see what the future may look like? And how do you drive new business models within that? I think the pace of change and the rate of change is exponential herein. And so organizations need to try things out, and they can't try things out physically all the time. They have to model things out and see whether they can try it out virtually. And analytics is a fantastic tool for that. So I think that's the first thing. I think the second thing, which is connected to that point, and the, certainly the point around the macro environment, is around smart action optimization, as we call it. And what we mean by that is, you know, we do a lot of analysis around insight and driving different options to make decisions. We don't do as much analysis, I don't think, as a world, around what actions were taken and was that the optimal action, or what actions can we predict and model out. So I think there'll be a big piece around, you know, moving and shifting the dial to smart action optimization over the next few years, and almost building libraries of actions that are taken within organizations so you can start to reuse those as you would do reusing digital assets or insight and analytics. And the key part of that is it means you can nudge people into making better decisions.
All right, well, hey, I want to thank you so much for your time today. I know you had to give time away at dinner, more or less, from your family, given the time change. So thank you so much for your insights. This was really helpful, and I appreciate you joining me today on the show, Bernie.
No problem at all. Real pleasure. I've just noticed how light it is your end and how dark it is my end. But that's the joy of, you know, virtual working in a COVID world across the world. But hopefully we'll get to meet at some point again soon, Bill.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
And I think the final part is probably around the ethical side. I mean, we talk about ethical analytics and ethical data science and ethical use of data. But when we talk about ethical analytics, we're talking about in the context of, can you make decisions that are maybe better for the environment, people and planet, but still optimal from a commercial and operational point of view? And we have a kind of simple way of looking at the world, or I have a simple way of looking at the world, which is, I look at leaders and organizations as either future takers, and those organizations and leaders are very commercial and operationally driven. They may make some token gestures to people and planet, or or embark on initiatives because they're asked to or told to, or their customers expect it. And then you have future makers. And I think future makers are where the focus is starting to get real attention. And they're leaders who want to make, you know, obviously commercial operational gains for organizations and grow businesses, but they also believe inherently in making a difference and leaving a legacy of change that's people and planet positive. And so I think the third trend will be around that, you know, how do we do analytics around the ethical side of how businesses operate, how leaders make decisions, how we can drive sustainability and ESG to much more beneficial outcomes, but make that part of everyday business decisions. I think the current view is that we kind of do it as a separate activity. It's a bit like data science was a few years back. Data science was a separate function and then integrated into business decision making. Sustainability feels like a separate function and it could be brought into everyday decision making as well. So.
Hey, Bernie. Do I have you back?
Yep.
Okay. So you said, here's what we'll do. We'll have to splice this. I think we talked over each other. I thought you had stopped and I think you had said in the third piece and you had kind of gotten into it and then it went out. So let's pause for about 2 seconds and then do whatever your final minute there was. And then I'll wrap it from there. Okay. So go ahead, pause for three and go with the third piece.
I think the kind of third macro point is around what we call ethical analytics. And we talk a lot about ethical use of data and ethical use of analytics. But when we talk about ethical analytics, we're talking about the kind of optimization of ethical impact on the world or ethical value on the world. So in terms of sustainability, in terms of well-being, in terms of positive people and planet impact. And I have a simple way of looking at the world, which is through two lenses. There's the first lens, which is future takers and leaders and organizations that behave in that way. And future takers are those individuals and organizations that are very commercial and operationally driven. They drive value for the business, but primarily for their stakeholders. They may make some token gestures to people and planet, but it's more because they have to rather than they inherently believe it. And so there'll be some activity going on in sustainability, but it'll be limited and it might have limited impact. And then on the other side of the spectrum, you have future makers, and they're the leaders that really believe in leaving a legacy of change and a lasting difference. So leaders who want to be people and planet positive, really drive the ethical agenda, but also be commercial and operationally effective. And I think up until now, it's been really interesting in that sustainability, ESG, initiatives around well-being have almost been separate to the organization. They've been separate functions within businesses. And it's a bit like data science was, you know, 3 to 5 years ago. You know, you'd have a separate function looking at data science or analytics within a business. And now it's a lot more integrated into those conversations we talked about earlier. And I think that's where the third macro trend is going. It's around how do we make a people and planet positive difference? How do we really pioneer as those future makers that leave a legacy of change? And how do we do so in a way that integrates that, not separates it from everyday decision making within organizations? And so that future maker piece, using ethical analytics and weaving that into everyday decisions to be commercially, operationally and ethically better, I think is the really big trend that will be coming out of the next year, particularly given with COVID and the focus on purpose, meaning and value from organizations and the climate positive action we look for now. So, yeah.